The only political victories that matter these days are symbolic. Attacking your opponents on cable news or social media. Compromise is a dirty word.
No, not really, but the name Kyrsten Sinema is.
I believe in my approach, but it's not what America wants right now.
No, it is not. See ya, Kyrsten. Don't let the door hit ya.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio, Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Forgive me once again for week three of my unending sinus infection and cold that I think is now beginning to spread to Desi Doyen.
Yeah, it might be. We'll see.
Well, you're welcome. I owe you after that whole COVID thing in January, but let's not go there. Welcome to the Bradcast. Hey, correction. As you know, we like to put them up front whenever possible. For some reason, amid my cold medicine-fueled coverage last week, I somehow managed to get the date of this year's State of the Union address wrong. In fact, Joe Biden will give this year's address to a joint session of Congress this Thursday night, March 7th. Am I right about this? Checking it again? Yes, March 7th, beginning at about 9 p.m. Eastern time. That is 6 p.m. Out here in California. That is just part of a busy week ahead as voters headed to polls in 16 states on Tuesday in the largest nominating contest day of the year. On Monday, however, in rural North Dakota's GOP caucuses, Donald Trump easily bested Nikki Haley, his last remaining competition there, to pick up all of the state's 29 delegates, inching him closer to the 1,215 that are needed to clinch the Republican Party's 2024 presidential nomination. Trump now has 273 delegates as we go to air. That's compared to Haley's 43. Though, as mentioned, while it sounds like both are far from the 1,215 that are needed to win the GOP nomination, some 835 delegates were up for grabs across 16 states on Tuesday when voters went to the polls for the Super Tuesday primary contest, including the presidential races for both major parties, in which there is little suspense this year, as both Joe Biden and Donald Trump are expected to soon secure their party's nominations. That, even though I know there are still folks, a lot of folks out there, particularly on the Democratic-leaning side, who seem to be under the impression that someone else other than Joe Biden is going to somehow step in to replace him, despite there being no evidence, zero, none, to support that notion. I'm underscoring that because I still hear from people via email saying, hey, do you think there's any chance that Joe Biden's going to be replaced by someone? No. unless he dies before November, Joe Biden will be the party's nominee by all available evidence, despite misleading information that is still being pushed out from the right-wing media on this. Apparently, that's where it's coming from.
Oh, of course.
So there is very little suspense in this year's Democratic primaries, even with self-help guru Marianne Williamson and Congressman Dean Phillips on the Democratic ballot in a number of states. Biden's biggest competitor appears to be a challenge from the uncommitted ballot line available in a number of states. The president's easy Michigan primary win last week also included an uncommitted campaign organized by activists who disapprove of his handling of Israel's war in Gaza. Allies of the uncommitted vote are pushing similar protests elsewhere, including in Minnesota on Tuesday, where the state has a significant population of Muslims. So we'll keep our eyes on that. But as more voters are coming to terms with the binary choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump that will almost certainly be faced by voters at the polls this November, there are actually signs that Joe Biden's numbers against Trump are beginning to rise along with it in with people's understanding that, yeah, he's going to be the candidate. Along with the pre-election polling. We will leave that for another day, but there does seem to be some sort of a correlation going on there. Now, for what it's worth, in a best-case scenario on the Republican side, or worst-case scenario, depending on how you look at it, where Donald Trump wins all of the available GOP delegates from Super Tuesday, if my math is correct, he would still fall just shy of the number needed to clinch his party's nomination, though not by many, with 1,108 delegates in his column. Again, if my math is right. So that would be about 100 delegates shy of what he would need, presuming a best case or worst case scenario, to foreclose the possibility of a miracle turnaround from Nikki Haley prior to the GOP convention this summer. So with that in mind, Trump will himself almost certainly be the Republican presidential nominee again in 2024, unless he dies between now and then. Next Tuesday, we will see a GOP nominating contest with more than enough delegates available to get Trump over that clinch number with primaries in Mississippi, Washington State, and the great unverifiable touchscreen voting state of Georgia. With the most delegates, I think 59 will be up for grabs in the Peach State next week, along with GOP caucuses in Hawaii and then in the Northern Mariana Islands on Friday and a Guam Territorial GOP convention on Saturday. The earliest that either of the party's front-running nominees can become his party's presumptive nominee with the delegates needed to clinch is March 12, that's next week for Trump, and March 19 for Joe Biden, according to AP's analysis. While much of the focus, they note, is on the presidential race on Super Tuesday, there are also important down-ballot contests as well. California voters are choosing, yes.
What? You mean there are other elections things, going yes. on with actual races that directly affect people's lives?
Other
what?
Reasons to show up to vote. If you're not either delighted or you're already bored by the presidential race, California voters are choosing candidates who will compete to fill the Senate seat long held by Dianne Feinstein. The governor's race is taking shape in North Carolina, perhaps pitting the state's popular Democratic attorney general against its far-right, Holocaust-denying Republican lieutenant governor. If Democrats are lucky, in a state that both parties are fiercely contesting ahead of November, and here in L.A., a progressive prosecutor is attempting to fend off an intense re-election challenge in a contest that could serve as a barometer of the politics of crime for both parties this year, even as crime rates continue to plummet following some pandemic highs. We will, of course, have full coverage of the reported results of Super Tuesday on our next broadcast, even if, depending on how the California U.S. Senate race shapes up, with three progressive members of Congress and one Republican
former baseball star running for the top two slots to go on to the general elections in November. It may take a while before we actually know who the two candidates will definitely be, given that California takes about a month to ensure that all votes are properly received and tallied and reported. So far, I'm happy to say, particularly given the number of states voting on Tuesday, that there have been very few reports of voting system failures across the 16 states that are in play this week. A number of so-called glitches and hiccups and snags and snafus, as the media loves to minimize them, to minimize voting system failures. Just a number have popped up in some Texas counties, of course, where touchscreen systems and or voter registration computers failed when the polls opened, though most of those issues appear to have been quickly taken care of, according to the reports that I have seen to date. As usual, we always caution that problems with computerized voting and tabulation systems do not necessarily reveal themselves until after the polls have closed, sometimes days or weeks or even longer after Election Day. If you've seen something at either your own polling location or in your local media outlet on any of this that you think I should be aware of, do feel free to drop me email via bradcast@bradblog.com. And, of course, we will have more on that tomorrow as well, as known and or warranted, along with the Super Tuesday results. One of the reasons we often see fewer problems in primary elections than on election days, of course, is because there's generally, not always, but generally less competition between the parties, certainly. So there's less gamesmanship and dirty tricks on many levels. And of course, this year, with little competition at all in either of the presidential races, and so sparse turnout and therefore fewer lines, there may be even fewer problems than usual this year in the primaries, which of course is generally a very good thing. But don't let it fool you. A new report out from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, published over the weekend, looks at the bigger picture of growing racial disparities in turnout following the corrupted right-wing U.S. Supreme Court overturning the most important provision of the landmark Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County ruling of 2013. The gap in voter participation between Black and white Americans, according to Brennan Center, decreased following the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s. Well, that's good. Unfortunately, their research shows that for more than a decade, this trend has now been reversing. The racial turnout gap, or the difference in the turnout rates between white and non-white voters, is a key way of measuring participation equality. And they find that the gap has consistently grown since 2012 and is growing most quickly in parts of the country that were previously covered under Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that section that was suspended by the Supreme Court in its 2013 decision in Shelby County versus Holder. Section 5 of the VRA required jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination in voting to pre-clear any changes to their voting policies and practices and laws with the U.S. Department of Justice or federal courts before new, potentially racially discriminatory changes could be put into effect in an actual election. But in the 2013 Shelby County decision, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, argued that the formula used to determine which jurisdictions would be subject to preclearance was not, in fact, reflective of current political realities and that the formula was thus unconstitutional. The court agreed that the original coverage formula's reliance in part on low turnout was justified back in the 60s and 70s, but they concluded that the contemporary turnout gaps should be used instead to assess current coverage. Until then, and until Congress updated the Voting Rights Act to try to implement a new formula for which areas should be covered by preclearance, that part of the law has been effectively gutted. The court notes Brennan Center relied heavily on turnout rates to substantiate its argument, writing that in the 2012 presidential election, quote, African-American voter turnout has come to exceed white voter turnout in five or six states that were originally covered by Section 5. Well, that sounds pretty good. That was back in 2012.
Right before they took away the formula that helped make that happen to be
yeah,
so.
Yeah, but what else happened in 2012? Who else was on the ballot?
Ah, yes.
That may have changed things. Yes, that was low turnout gaps in 2012. It turns out were likely due to the fact that Barack Obama's presidential candidacy was taking place. And according to Brennan Center, it did not demonstrate that preclearance was no longer needed. That moment on its own, and that's what they used. Well, look, in 2012, last year, black voting rates were up. That was apparently unrepresentative of the general pattern showing, guess what, a sustained and growing racial turnout gap. And guess where Brennan Center found it to be growing the most? They said they find that while the gap is growing virtually everywhere, the white-black turnout gap in regions previously covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was about 5 percentage points greater than it would have been if the Voting Rights Act were still in full force. Put differently, the turnout gap grew almost twice as quickly in former covered jurisdictions as in other parts of the country with similar demographic and socioeconomic profiles.
In other words, mission accomplished.
So what's the main cause for that? Well, Brennan Center cites recent scholarship that finds restrictive voting laws generally limit the turnout of voters of color the most, including policies like polling place consolidation, photo ID voting restrictions. Moreover, they find many policies and practices that drive voting are not codified in state law. Take, for instance, voter list maintenance practices. Following the Shelby County decision, jurisdictions that previously had been required to pre-clear any changes to voting with the federal government dramatically increased the rate at which they began removing voters from the lists, even if state laws governing list maintenance had not changed. They just felt free to start tossing people off the lists. Brennan Center's study is based on the collection of nearly 1 billion vote records, allowing them to conduct this first-of-its-kind analysis. The gap, in fact, costs American democracy millions of ballots that go uncast by eligible voters, they find. It also has significant consequences for political candidates and their campaigns. In 2020, if the gap had not existed, 9 million more ballots would have been cast, according to Brennan Center. 9 million more ballots. That is far more than the 7 million ballots by which Biden won the national popular vote that year. In 32 different states, the number of uncast ballots due to the turnout gap was larger than the winning presidential candidate's margin of votes. That does not say, they note, that the racial turnout gap necessarily changed electoral outcomes in any given state, but the immensity of that figure does put the magnitude of the turnout gap into greater perspective. The gap matters, in fact, for our political system. Given that the racial turnout gap is growing around the country, not just in areas affected by Section 5, but the widening of the gap nationally cannot be solely attributed to the Supreme Court's decision. There are other reasons. We'll get to some of those in a moment. But the court perhaps emboldened jurisdictions that were not subject to preclearance to go ahead and enact new restrictive policies themselves, where the gap is now growing much faster in those jurisdictions, the ones that were covered, growing more quickly in counties that were formerly subject to Section 5 than in comparable parts of the country. A variety of statistical approaches supports the Brennan Center's conclusion that this more rapid growth in the turnout gap is, in fact, attributable to the court's decision in Shelby. In addition to the effects of Shelby County, that the in addition, the effect of Shelby County, they say, has been growing over time. The decision did not result in just a one-time increase, which could be some argument against as well. Those jurisdictions hadn't been able to clean up their roles, you know, without getting in trouble from the federal government for many years. But it wasn't just a one-time thing. The difference between formerly covered and other jurisdictions was larger in 2022 than in any election since the decision was handed down almost 10 years prior. Meanwhile, the federal government, unable to protect the political rights of people of color using the full power of the Voting Rights Act, which still exists but can't be fixed because largely Republicans in Congress, but the laws and practices that would have been subject to preclearance continue to accumulate and widen that gap.
So the racial voting gap is growing because of all of the new voter suppression laws that Republican-controlled states have been passing just since the 2020 election.
Correct. But it's not only Republicans to blame here. In fact, if it were not for just two supposed Democrats in the U.S. Senate about a year or so ago, the damage done by the U.S. Supreme Court in Shelby could have actually been corrected under Joe Biden, where Democrats in the U.S. House at the time had passed a measure that would have been the most comprehensive voting rights legislation since the landmark Voting Rights Act. The slim 51-49 Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate, while supposedly supporting the measure, all 51 of them, well, unfortunately, they were unable to adopt that measure in the U.S. Senate because of two right-wing Democrats. That would be with West Virginia's Joe Manchin. We spent just a little bit of time talking about him in recent years. And Arizona's Kirsten Sinema. We've also spoken about her very nicely over the past several years. Both Manchin and Sinema claimed to support this update to the Voting Rights Act, but they refused to make the necessary changes to the Senate filibuster process that would have been required to pass it, to allow the measure to pass without a supermajority of 60 votes, since there were zero Republicans who were willing to, you know, protect democracy. That, even though both Manchin and the Sinema at the time had claimed to support this democracy-saving measure. Well, since then, Joe Manchin has announced he will not be running for re-election in the U.S. Senate this year. Also, there was some thought that he might run as an independent or one of the third-party options for president. He's not going to do that either. And on Tuesday, Kirsten Sinema, after first leaving the party to become an independent herself, on Tuesday she announced she will not be running for another term, clearing the way for an actual Democrat to potentially fill her seat after this November and avoiding what was feared might have been a three-way race. Now, it will most likely be a two-way race, at least with the two major candidates. So if nothing else today, there is some potentially good news for Democrats. But none of this will be easy. Republicans are taking advantage of the weakened Voting Rights Act to do all sorts of things to undermine democracy between here and this November. As the New York Times reports this week, a network of right-wing activists and allies of Donald J. Trump is quietly challenging thousands of voter registrations in critical presidential battleground states, an all but unnoticed effort that could have an impact in close or contentious elections. Well, we never have to worry about that sort of thing in this country, do we? Calling themselves election investigators, the activists on the right have pressed local officials in states like Michigan and Nevada and Georgia to drop voters from the rolls en masse. They have targeted Democratic areas, specifically relying on new data programs and novel legal theories to justify their push. In one Michigan town, for example, more than 100 voters were removed after an activist lobbied officials, citing an obscure state law from the 1950s. In the Detroit suburb of Waterford, a clerk removed 1,000 people from the polls in response to a similar request. The ousted voters included an active duty Air Force officer who was wrongly removed, thankfully later reinstated. An activist apparently submitted to the town clerk the names of more than 1,000 voters, which they claimed had moved away and were no longer therefore eligible. But the names were pulled from the U.S. Postal Service's mail forwarding list, which is a database including people who are snowbirds who may not live in the same house all year round, active duty military personnel like that Air Force officer who was wrongly removed, and others who are still legally eligible to vote at their residence, no matter what it says on the U.S. Postal Service's mail forwarding list. The purge in Waterford, Michigan, in fact, went unnoticed by state election officials. That's troubling until the New York Times discovered it. The Michigan Secretary of State's office has since told the clerk to reinstate those voters, saying the removals did not follow the process that is laid out in state and federal law. And yes, we still have at least some federal laws to protect against this, at least in theory, at least if we find out about it. Thank you to the New York Times. And the secretary issued a warning to the state's 1,600 clerks about these and similar efforts that are going on below the radar. This, of course, is just one of the reasons that we encourage y'all to get out and vote in the primary elections, even in not particularly competitive ones. If nothing else, it helps you to learn the process, where your voting precinct is or should be, and ensures that you are registered to vote as you think you are since the last time you went to the polls, that you haven't been purged for some reason since then. Don't wait till election day to find out. Of course, voting in the primaries does not guarantee that another purge or a glitch or a hiccup or snafu won't remove you from the rolls between those primaries and the general elections in November, but it very well may help. So go do it. The Michigan activists are part of an expansive web of grassroots groups that formed after Donald Trump's attempt to steal the election in 2020, the one that he lost. The Times says the groups have made mass voter challenges a top priority this election year, spurred on by a former Trump lawyer, Cleta Mitchell. She was one of the attorneys who was on the phone call with Georgia when Donald Trump was threatening the Secretary of State there to find him enough votes to steal the state from Joe Biden. And by a group named True the Vote, a right-wing so-called vote monitoring group. They've got a long history of spreading misinformation, including in their now completely debunked so-called documentary film called 2000 Mules, which the actual filmmaker, a convicted election fraudster himself, who was pardoned by Donald Trump, and the leaders of True the Vote, they have admitted to state and federal prosecutors that they included claims from so-called whistleblowers and informants in that film who apparently do not actually exist at all. Their mission, according to these voter fraud fraudsters, is to maintain accurate voting records and remove voters who have moved to another jurisdiction. Well, that's fine, but that doesn't seem to be what they're really doing here. Democrats claim that they use these so-called excess registrations in order to stop. Well, no, they claim, I'm sorry, they claim that Democrats are using these so-called excess registrations for people who have since moved away in order to stuff ballot boxes and to steal elections. That theory, as the Times correctly details, has no actual grounding in fact. Investigations into voter fraud have found that it is exceedingly rare, and it does happen, but when it does, when it occurs, it's typically very isolated. It's often accidental. People who don't realize they have houses in two different states, they don't know, they're only allowed to vote from one of them. Election officials say there's no reason to think that the system in place for keeping voter lists up to date is failing in any way. The far bigger risk, they note, is disenfranchising voters. But of course, that's the point. It's difficult to know how to know precisely how many voters have been dropped from the rolls as a result of these campaigns. It's even harder to determine how many were dropped in error. But even when these campaigns fail, the challenges end up having consequences. In some states, a challenge alone is enough to limit a voter's access to a mail ballot or to require additional documentation when they show up at the polls. And privately, these right-wing activists have said they consider that to be a victory. Yes, that's the point. That's what they're trying to do. They're not trying to protect the sanctity of the vote. They are trying, in fact, to undermine it. At the same time, right-wing media outlets are busy promoting these challenges, encouraging them, casting public officials as somehow corrupt and creating fodder, trying to help Democrats, even when those officials are Republicans. But they come up with all sorts of stuff and nonsense that can then be taken and used in another round of legal challenges, particularly if Donald Trump loses again this November. Quote, "It really is aimed at being able to cast doubt on the results after the fact," said Joanna Lydgate, the chief executive of States United Democracy Center, a nonpartisan organization. But also, she notes, before the election itself, at being able to shape who turns out and how they turn out. Georgia, my favorite state, has seen by far the most challenges. 360,000 voters were challenged in the 2021 Senate runoff elections alone.
Wow.
360,000. In 2023, more than 8,600 voters had their registrations challenged in five major counties, according to data obtained by the Times. In many cases, a single voter brought thousands of challenges. Trust the votes, disgraced, but still at it, leader Catherine Engelbrecht has said the organization intends to ramp up the campaign ahead of the November election. So, yes, stay aware, stay awake, check your registration. You can do that when you go to vote in the primaries, or you can do it really any time. Contact your county and make sure you're registered as you believe you are.
Yes, and make sure that your friends and your family know about this stealth campaign by Republicans who are working really hard to purge as many people as they can from the polls. Help your friends and family understand the stakes and what they need to do to keep their registration active and ready.
So we will, of course, be monitoring these efforts, and I suspect there'll be many more of them in the months leading up to, and yes, beyond Election Day. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with yet another crime and accountability block ahead, and Desi Doyen's latest Greed News report as heat and wildfires continue to ravage Texas in February and March in an extreme blizzard with not unusual at all. Hurricane force winds batters part of California.
All fire of that, and ice.
Yep, all of that straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one, like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Please help the broadcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. We couldn't do any of this without you. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the broadcast.
Jail. The prison band was there, they began to wait. The band was jumping and the drum began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing that rock.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It looks like Donald Trump's longtime top financial guy is, yes, heading back to jail, even if Donald Trump isn't for the moment. That after that top financial guy had already served about 100 days in Rikers last year. Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of Donald Trump's company pleaded guilty on Monday in New York to lying under oath during his testimony in the ex-president's civil fraud case. His plea deal will send Weisselberg back to jail, but does not require him to testify at Trump's upcoming hush money criminal trial in New York. The 76-year-old Weisselberg, an apparently glutton for punishment or imprisonment in this case, he's the Trump Organization's longtime CFO. He was employed initially by Trump's father, Fred, some 50 years ago. He pleaded guilty in state court to two counts of perjury. He'll be sentenced to 5 months in jail, which would be his second stint after serving 100 days last year in a separate Trump Organization-related tax fraud case. Yes, I know. It's a lot to keep up with.
True.
Weisselberg has pleaded guilty to lying during his testimony in the case against Trump and his company and his top executives, where they were all accused of defrauding banks to get favorable rates on loans over the past decade or more. The Manhattan prosecutor's office said in a statement on Monday, it is a crime to lie in depositions and at trial. The counts to which Weisselberg pleaded guilty related to his testimony in a July 2020 deposition in New York Attorney General Letitia James's case against Trump. He also admitted on Monday that he lied on the witness stand at the civil fraud trial last fall and at related a related deposition in May of 2023. Weisselberg surrendered early Monday and entered the state courtroom in handcuffs. He admitted lying when he testified that he had little knowledge of or awareness of how Trump's penthouse at Trump Tower in Manhattan came to be overvalued on financial statements based on figures listing it to be three times its actual size. The Manhattan penthouse was valued on his financial statements from at least 2012 to 2016 as though it measured 30,000 square feet, which would make it possibly the largest such apartment in the world. In fact, it was closer to a third of that size. It was about 11,000 square feet. Weisselberg is still on probation for the original tax fraud case in which he and his family were found to have received millions of dollars in gifts and perks from the Trump Organization that went unreported as taxable income. In agreeing to a new five-month jail sentence, prosecutors cited Weisselberg's age and his willingness to admit wrongdoing, at least once he was caught. In New York, perjury is a felony punishable up to 7 years in prison. So, yeah, another Trumper appears to be getting off relatively easy again.
For decades of crime.
The judge in Trump's civil fraud case ruled last month that Trump and Weisselberg and others schemed to deceive banks and insurers and others by lying about his wealth on financial statements to the tune of billions of dollars each year to make deals and secure loans, along with penalizing Trump some $455 million. Judge Arthur Engoron ordered Weisselberg to pay $1 million. That's the amount of severance that he has received from the Trump Organization to date. They, are appealing that case, that state court ruling, though without judges on the state court that Donald Trump actually handpicked. As in the various federal cases we have been discussing of late, his chances of getting off the hook in New York are, I would say, substantially dimmed. But we shall see. A bit of crime and accountability news on the Democratic side for a change from the apparently wildly corrupt New Jersey U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. New obstruction of justice crimes were added on Tuesday to charges against Menendez and his wife, Nadine, that allege they accepted gold bars and cash and a luxury car in return for favors that the senator carried out to assist three businessmen. The new charges were in a rewritten so-called superseding indictment that was returned against the Democrat in Manhattan federal court on Tuesday. An indictment already alleges that the couple conspired with the three men to accept bribes in return for the senator's help in projects that the men were pursuing. Both Menendez and his wife have pleaded not guilty, along with two of the three businessmen. A May trial has been scheduled. One businessman pleaded guilty to charges just last week and has agreed to testify at trial against the others. That's probably not good news for Bob.
Nope.
After his fall arrest, Menendez, who is still serving in the U.S. Senate, he was forced to at least relinquish his chairmanship of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which he has been accused of using to profit in a number of these related schemes, but he has said he will not resign from Congress. That said, he had been charged with felony crimes in the past, and he was acquitted at trial, or at least, as I recall, it was a hung jury. Prosecutors decided they wouldn't refile the same charges, I think. So who knows? Maybe he'll get off again. In addition to the existing charges that Menendez and his wife accepted gold bars and cash from a real estate developer in return for the senator using his clout to get that guy a multi-million-dollar deal with a Qatari investment fund and helping another New Jersey business associate get a big deal with the government of Egypt. These new charges, the new allegations, according to prosecutors, say that Menendez caused his then attorney to meet with prosecutors last June and September to say that the senator had been unaware until 2022 of a $23,000 payment that one of the businessmen had made to the company holding the mortgage on Menendez's New Jersey home, or the money that another defendant had paid toward a Mercedes-Benz convertible. He had no idea. Well, he knew, but he told the lawyer, "I don't know." And the lawyer then reported that. Conspiracy. The prosecutors wrote that Menendez knew and, quote, had learned of both the mortgage company payment and the car payments prior to 2022. And they were not, in fact, loans, as Menendez caused his lawyer to claim, but in fact, they were bribe payments. I think Bob Menendez is in big trouble.
Yes, it does sound like it.
And I don't know why. Actually, I think, I don't know if they're allowed to vote to expel him. For example, the way they expelled in the House, they expelled George Santos. I don't know if they have the same thing over in the Senate. But boy, it sure seems like he should not be a serving, sitting senator at this point. But he says he's not going, and he's innocent of all the charges, and we will see.
We'll just let the justice play out, I guess.
And one more today, back to the Republicans, as usual, I guess. Liberty Biberty. Nope, not that Liberty, but Liberty University. Liberty University, the so-called Christian school, has agreed to pay an unprecedented $14 million fine for the school's failure to disclose information about crimes on its campus and for its treatment of sexual assault survivors, according to the U.S. Department of Education, which made the announcement on Tuesday. The fine that the school has agreed to is by far the largest ever levied under the Clery Act, a law that requires even private colleges and universities like Liberty, but which receive federal funding, to simply collect data on campus crime and notify students of various threats. The school must disseminate an annual security report, including crime reports and information on efforts to improve campus safety. But apparently, Liberty thinks the law doesn't apply to it because, you know, it's Christian or something. Liberty had marketed itself for years as having one of the nation's safest campuses, with more than 15,000 students enrolled at the school in Lynchburg, Virginia. In fact, they've got something like 150,000 students online and so forth, but they got 15,000 at the campus in Lynchburg, Virginia. But its police department had one single officer with minimal oversight to investigate any crimes, apparently, during most of the time period that was reviewed by federal investigators from 2016 to 2023. The U.S. Department of Education said it identified numerous cases that resulted in the misclassification or underreporting of crimes. I'm sure that was just an accident. And there were several incidents that the university determined to be unfounded without evidence that the initial report was false. But it wasn't. According to the settlement agreement, this was especially common with respect to sexually based offenses, including rape and fondling cases. Federal investigators cited a case, for example, in which a woman reported being raped with the attacker telling her that he had a knife. According to the settlement agreement, Liberty's investigators, however, quote, unfounded this case based on a claim that the quote, victim indicates that she consented to the sexual act. In point of fact, the victim's own statement merely indicated that she, quote, gave in an attempt to get away from the perpetrator. Many victims of sexual crimes feared reporting because of concerns of reprisal. The agreement stated several were punished for violating the student code of conduct, known as the Liberty Way, while their assailants were left unpunished. Consequently, victims of sexual assault often felt dissuaded by Liberty Administration's reputation for punishing sexual assault survivors instead of helping them, according to the agreement. Such fears created a culture of silence where sexual assaults commonly went unreported. The school said it would continue to cooperate with the Department of Education, and it noted that it has made more than $10 million in significant improvements since 2022 toward complying with the Clery Act and other laws. Before this agreement on Tuesday, this $14 million agreement, before this, the largest Clery Act fine in history was $4.5 million against Michigan State in 2019. Federal investigators in that case said that Michigan State failed to adequately respond to sexual assault complaints against Larry Nassar, the campus sports doctor who molested elite gymnasts and other female athletes for years. For that, in 2019, under the Trump administration, they had to pay just $4.5 million. Liberty now is agreeing to pay $14 million. In 2016, Pennsylvania State University was hit with a then-record fine of $2.4 million in the wake of child sex abuse complaints against former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. But the $14 million fine against Liberty appears to be a small fraction of its total operating revenues, even though it's a record amount. Its operating revenues were $1.2 billion in fiscal year 2022. The school's net assets were $3.5 billion. Liberty has, meanwhile, become one of the largest Christian schools in the nation since its 1971 co-founding by religious broadcaster Jerry Falwell Sr. Lawsuits by former students and employees have accused the school of botching sexual assault reports or failing to investigate rape allegations. Liberty settled another a civil lawsuit that was filed by 12 women 2 years ago after they had accused the school of fostering an unsafe environment and mishandling cases of sexual assault and harassment. The lawsuit said the university had a, quote, tacit policy of waiting investigations in favor of the accused male students, and said the university retaliated against women who did make such reports.
My goodness. I mean, it raises the question about whether $14 million, the largest fine yet for such for failing to follow the law, yep. It will be interesting to see if that's actually a deterrent of any kind.
We'll see. The announcement comes 3 years after Liberty's acrimonious split with its former president, Jerry Falwell Jr., whose exit followed his posting of a provocative photo of himself online,
yeah,
as well as revelations of his wife's extramarital affair. Perhaps that's the real Liberty way. Liberty Biberty. The Green News Report is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Well, at least if we could stop Texas and California and the extreme weather that has been going on. By the way, both of those states participating in Super Tuesday. I wonder if they're making any accommodations for the wildfires in Texas or the blizzard in California. We will look into that.
One hopes.
But now, it's our latest Green News Report.
And people are praying for this rain.
The largest wildfire in Texas history continues to burn while California gets buried by an extreme blizzard. Increased risk of megafires pushing insurers to leave Texas and California. Plus, the Biden administration invests billions to clean up the nation's ports.
Any port in a storm, all of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
How dangerous is the situation? What's the federal government doing? And do you think that the climate crisis has anything to do with this?
No, why would the climate crisis have anything to do with it? A million acres burned amid 80-degree heat in Texas in February? It's all totally normal. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, snarky comments aside, it's kind of troubling that it is kind of totally normal these days. These wildfires we're seeing in Texas, these 10 feet of snow in the Sierras up here in California?
Yes, the extremes are getting quite extreme.
Do you think it has anything to do with our climate crisis?
I think so.
Oh, well, what nightmares you got for us today, Des?
Well, first, the largest wildfire in Texas state history continues to grow and expand into Oklahoma and is so large it is visible from space. As we go to air, the Smokehouse Creek Fire, one of several in the dry Texas panhandle, so far has killed at least two people, thousands of cattle, and destroyed hundreds of structures. The blaze, intensified by record heat and extreme dryness, has burned more than 1,700 square miles, an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. The Texas fire is also a warning for other central U.S. states. The U.S. Drought Monitor last week reported that hot and dry fire conditions now stretch from northern New Mexico all the way to Iowa.
It's totally normal.
In California, a massive powerful blizzard hammered the northern part of the state over the weekend with hurricane-force wind gusts, dumping more than 7 feet of snow, knocking out power for thousands of homes and businesses, shutting down ski resorts, and closing long stretches of Interstate 80 with no estimate for reopening. Forecasters say that more heavy snow is on the way. However, a Lake Tahoe resident, who's also a project manager for electric car maker Rivian, posted on social media that he powered his home for more than 24 hours using only his Rivian electric truck and said his vehicle lost only about 15% of battery life over the entire time.
Nice.
Now, it will take time for scientists to identify the exact influence of climate change on the California storm, but extremier extremes are in line with climate scientists' predictions.
There were 190 mile per hour winds. That is not only hurricane force winds, that's category 6 hurricane force winds if we had a category 6 hurricane.
Scientists say climate change is making wildfires more frequent and more devastating and raising the risk of huge megafires, and insurers are paying attention. The New York Times reports that the growing fire risk is already affecting the insurance market in Texas, increasing premiums for homeowners, with some insurers already moving to exit from parts of the state. Several more insurance companies announced they will leave California and Florida due to the increasing cost of rebuilding after disasters. On CNN on Sunday, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was emphatic on the critical need to build climate resilience now.
We, as a country and as a world have to be ready for the increasing effects of extreme weather caused by climate change. It's a remarkable phenomenon, and it will manifest itself in the days to come, and we have to prepare for it now.
In the days to come, tell that to folks in Texas and up in the Sierras in California.
In other news, Pennsylvania's Allegheny County has fined U.S. Steel nearly $2 million for violating air pollution standards more than 360 times over the last 2 years. It's the eighth enforcement action the county health department has issued against the company's 120-year-old steel mill over just the last few years. The latest fine, though, amounts to only 0.1% of U.S. Steel's profits last year. The company says it will appeal the fine. Meanwhile, the childhood asthma rate in nearby towns is 3 times higher than the national average.
Just another coincidence.
Finally, a bit of good news. The Biden administration has launched a $3 billion program with funding to upgrade the nation's ports, to cut air pollution and decarbonize them with zero emissions port equipment and infrastructure. Funded by the Democrats' landmark Inflation Reduction Act, the new Clean Ports program will particularly benefit low-income communities living near industrialized harbors that are disproportionately affected by the port's really heavy pollution.
Very cool. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, clean it up. Yeah, clean it up. I've had enough.
Me too.
Clean
Thank
it
you
up,
very
baby.
Much, Desi Doyen. Wow. We were sharing the Green News Report with you there. I looked up what's going on in the Texas Panhandle with those fires and how that is affecting voting on Super Tuesday. The county election official said that there have been very limited disruptions, and that's due in large part to the absolute resilience and planning by those county officials. That actually, according to a Texas Secretary of State spokesperson, that's good. I hope folks were able to get out to vote in Texas. That said, it's got, I think, if not 49th or 50th, they are, if not the
among
lowest
the worst.
Turnout in the country when it comes to voting in Texas, because
yep.
A lot of state officials in Texas really prefer it if people don't vote.
True. Please Sad but true.
Please ruin their days by voting, whether it's in Texas or anywhere else over the next few months. All right, we have got to get out. We will have results of Tuesday's Super Tuesday elections on our next thrilling broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can always download them for free. Going back to the beginning of time at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough and thoughtful enough to help us stay on your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. Drop a few bucks there today. Help me buy a little bit more cold medicine. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Yeah, clean it up. Yeah, clean it up. I've had enough.
Thank you. All right. Clean it up. That's good advice.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act has been reintroduced in the U.S. Senate, backed by virtually every civil rights and democracy organization in the country. What is this landmark bill, and why should you and Congress care about it? In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court in Shelby v. Holder struck down Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Section 5 included a formula for requiring states and municipalities with a track record of voter suppression to have any new election law be subject to review by the U.S. Justice Department. In 1965, that meant states which had suppressed black voters, but it later included Arizona and Alaska for allowing language barriers to suppress Native American and Hispanic voters. Striking down the formula removed that oversight and opened a floodgate of conservative voter suppression laws, including horrendous omnibus bills in Georgia, Florida, Texas, and others. But while the Supreme Court struck down the formula, it does allow Congress to fix it. The John Lewis Act is that fix. If a state has 15 or more voting rights or racial gerrymandering violations, or if the state has 10 violations and the state legislature or officials participated, it can trigger 10 years of federal oversight. The bill had a simple majority in the Senate in 2021, but didn't have the 60 votes to overcome the filibuster. We have more on this important bill and the groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.